Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the second in our third-part series focusing on the splendor of the Seder. Our shiur tonight is sponsored Le'ilui Nishmat Shlomo Yonah ben Yisrael Eli HaKohen, Shelby Ernstein, and his father, whose yahrzeit is tonight and tomorrow. If you would like to sponsor either an individual shiur or an entire series of shiurim, please let me know. Additionally, if you would like to subscribe to and have not yet subscribed to my pre-Pesach newsletter, where I will be sharing Pesach ideas, and then hopefully after Pesach, other things. There will be a link in the chat after this shiur, and also there will be a link in the YU Torah page. But with that, we turn definitely the first time tonight to how we began the shiur, how we ended the shiur last week, which was after learning about the meaning of the word Haggadah and how that gives us a mandate for the entire Seder. I had noted. The way Rambam frames the commandment in source number one. Mitzvat asei shel Torah l'saper b'nisim v'niflaot she'na'asu la'avotenu b'mitzrayim b'leil 15 b'nisan. We have a positive biblical obligation to be l'saper, to tell the story. Sipur yitziat Mitzrayim. And he learns Talmud lomav v'higadata levincha b'yom ha'olemo, that we have to do this act of sipur, learned out from the same verse that teaches us the word for Haggadah. And b'sha'a she'yesh matzah u'maro munachim lefanach, and it has to be done when matzah and maro are placed before us. So the question I had asked and I had ended with last week was whether Sipur is a synonym for Haggadah, and therefore everything that we said last week also applies to Sipur. Or is there some additional component to Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, which, spoiler alert, if we're doing a whole shiur on it, is probably the case. If there is an additional component to Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim that we also have to be cognizant of at our Seder. And to understand this, we have to take a look at one of the best-known Mishnayot in Judaism, because it gets quoted in the Haggadah. Source number two, Rabban Gamliel, Haya Omer. Rabban Gamliel would say, Kol Shalom Amar shlosha devarim elu b'Pesach. Whoever does not mention these three matters on Pesach, lo yatzah yidei chovato, has not fulfilled that obligation. Ve'elu hein, and these are Pesach, matzah, umaro. You have to mention all three in order to fulfill your obligation. And we kind of recite this at the Seder almost as a function of liturgy, right? We don't really focus on exactly what it means. We go through a little bit of a ceremony, admittedly, where we don't point at the Korban Pesach because we don't have it, but we point at the matzah, we point at the maror, we talk a little bit about them. But what exactly, this is a halachic demand. What exactly is Rabban Gamliel saying here? And when he speaks of this chovah, this obligation, that you are either yatzah or lo yatzah, that you either fulfill or you don't. What is this obligation? It's very abstract, the way it's framed here. It's just anyone who does not mention these things has not fulfilled that obligation. But Seder night has many different obligations. We have an obligation of matzah. We have an obligation of maror. We have an obligation of four cups. What is Rabban Gamliel referring to? So one school of thought, which is championed by Ramban and Nachmanides in his commentary to the pages of the Rif, the Milchamot Hashem, that Rabban Gamliel is referring to the obligation of the Korban Pesach, the Pesach sacrifice, that historically in the times of the Beit HaMikdash needed, you know, was the focal point. It was eaten on Seder night. But it wasn't enough for people to just eat the Korban Pesach. You actually had to, you know, talk about it. You had to have a certain amount of conversation about what you were eating. There is, however, a different opinion. And it is a fundamentally different opinion that really opens our entire discussion tonight. And it comes from the Kiryat Sefer. The Kiryat Sefer was Rabbi Moshe Ditrani, the Mabit. He was a 16th century rabbi. He was born in Ottoman Greece. He moved to Tzfat. And the Kiryat Sefer is a really, really eclectic work. And it's a commentary on one way to frame it, which is not doing it justice. It's a commentary on anything he felt was interesting. But one of the things he does is he tries to explain perplexing passages in the Rambam. And so he explains V'imlo amar, so he's basing himself on a Rambam quoting Rabban Gamliel. Upireish ta'amei shlosh dvarim elu ba Pesach. And the reason specifically these three things on Pesach, these three foods, shehein Pesach matzah umaro, Pesach matzah umaro, lo yatza yidei chovat, sipo yitziat Mitzrayim. Your obligation to retell the story of the Exodus, if you do not, while telling that story, mention the Korban Pesach, mention the matzah, mention the maror, you've not actually fulfilled your obligation of Sipor. And in truth, Rambam seems to say this explicitly just a little bit later on in Halacha 5 of Chapter 7 of his Laws of Chametz and Matzah. Kol mi shelo amar shlosha dvarim elu b'leil chamisha asar. Anyone who does not mention these three things on Pesach, lo yatza yidei chovat, has not fulfilled their obligation, ve'elu hein Pesach matzah u'maror, u'dvarim ha'elu kulan nikroin Haggadah. And these three things, the Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, are also called Haggadah. There is a clear thread, starting with Rabban Gamliel, and as he is understood by the commentators, that one of the major goals of the Seder is to look at the Pesach, and in our days, the matzah and the maror, in some ways having a storytelling function. And before we go any further, I do just want to point out, and we'd actually touched on this in last year's series when we talked about the development and the history of the Haggadah, there's another good reason to think that this is what Rabban Gamliel is actually referring to, that he's referring in some way to the mitzvah of Sipor Yitziat Mitzrayim, that the obligation he refers to is that. Because if we take a look at source 5, this is the Mishnah just before the statement of Rabban Gamliel. And the Mishnah, it's a very, very lengthy Mishnah that basically tells us the fundamental principles of the core part of the Seder. Mazgulokos sheni, they pour a second cup. V'kan haben shoel aviv, this is where the son asks his father. V'im ein dat baben aviv melamdo. And if the son doesn't know, doesn't have anything to ask, his father teaches him. This is irrelevant to our Shir series, but I'll point it out once again. Manishna halala zemikala halilot was very clearly supposed to be the questions asked by the father to his children. It was not the questions the children asked, but actually the prompts by the parents to get the children to start noticing things that were going on. Again, not a topic for today, but just always, always worth pointing out because it's cool how it has morphed into the opposite nowadays. Ulefi da'ato shel ben, the Mishnah continues, and according to the knowledge of the child, aviv malamdo, his father should teach him, matchil bignut umesayim b'shevach. You begin the story by talking about the disgrace of the Jewish people, and you end with their praise, then it continues, and you expand Arami Oved Avi until you finish the entire parasha. What does it mean? Matchil beginus umesayim b'shevach. So the Gemara has a debate whether it begins with avadim hayinu, we start talking about being slaves and redeemed, or we start talking about having been idolaters, and now we're no longer idolaters. We do both in the Seder. But one way of, and this is probably pshat, this is probably the literal meaning of the Mishnah. Rabban Gamliel is coming and nuancing the point made in the previous Mishnah. The whole theme of Mishnah 4 is Sipo Yitziat Mitzrayim, in the classic sense, what we understand it to be. Tell your children the story of the Exodus. Rabban Gamliel comes along and says, no. Kol shelo amar shlosha dvarim elu b'pesach. If you don't mention these three foods, lo yatza yidei chovato, you still don't fulfill your obligation. It's not enough to be matchil beginut umesayim b'shevach. It's not enough to tell the story of our Exodus. It's not enough to tell the story of our religious progression from idolaters to believers. Rather, you also have to incorporate all of the foods. And Rav Soloveitchik took this to maybe the most intense expression in his Shi'urim Lezecher Abba Mari. So just out of, you know, it's important to point out, most of the Gemara Talmud Shiurim we have of Rav Soloveitchik are notes from his students that have been typed out and published. The only thing that he wrote himself and published were the transcripts of the Shiurim he would do in memory of his father, which are the most intense things you could possibly ever try and learn. If you've ever listened to a Rav Soloveitchik idea and you're like, this seems pretty intense, these are like that dialed up to, well, the dial's broken off. It's so intense. So in exploring a little bit of this theme, Rav Soloveitchik says the following. V'nira d'yeshnam shnei kiyomim b'pesach matzomaro. It seems that there are two essentially different aspects of two different mitzvot, in a sense. It's really the same mitzvah, but there's two different aspects to it of Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. The first of which, Aleph, Etzem Torat Echiltam al pi gzerot hakatuv, de be'erev tochlu matzot al matzot umorim yochluhu v'achlu et habasar b'layla hazeh. The first is simply an obligation to eat. The Torah says repeatedly we need to eat these various foods. Find the first thing you need to fulfill. The first aspect of the mitzvah you need to fulfill is simply put them in your mouth and swallow. Boom. You did it. You ate it. Kiyom mitzvat elu na'aseh umitgashem al yidei pu'ulat achila. And this is fulfilled simply through the act of eating. Shehi tchilat usof ha-mitzvah. This is, it's fundamentally a mitzvah in and of itself. The second, however, is Kiyum sipo yitziat mitzrayim, that's a typo, sorry, al yidei achilat pesach matzah umaro, al pi gzerot hakatov du ba'avo zeh asha Hashem li b'tzeitim mitzrayim. The fulfillment of these three as a function of sipo yitziat mitzrayim. You're not just eating them, but through the eating of them, you are telling the story. You are telling the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim through these foods themselves, through historically the Pesach, and nowadays through the Matzah and Maror. Again, Ba'avor Zeh, Asa Hashem Li B'Tzeitim Mitzrayim, the verse we focused on so much last week, that same strength of feeling that passion that I spoke about last week. I'm sure what everyone was thinking was I was talking about Magid. As we tell the story of our leaving Egypt, that's the point we need to have all of these emphatic, strident beliefs. No. That is true. Very much so. But it doesn't end there. I think often we have this mentality at the Seder. Once we've reached the conclusion of Magid, we've made the bracha, we've had our cup and we get to the food. It's like, well, we're done. It's all clear sailing from here. Very nice. We get to sing. We get to eat. It's all very good. No. The obligation of Sipo Yitziat Mitzrayim does not end with Magid. It continues through the foods that we eat. Straight after Magid, we go into Rachza, Motzi Matzah, and Maror. We're going to leave Korech aside. But we go into the washing for and then the eating of the Matzah. And then we also have the eating of the Maror. And these also need to tell the story. And so what I want to do for the rest of this evening is go through these three stages, Rachza, Motzi Matzah, and Maror, and share a few ideas as to how these also, in some, I think, very significant ways, either tell the story or help prepare us to further tell the story the way we should be doing as we eat these foods. These foods are as much a part of Sipo Yitziat Mitzrayim as saying Avadim Hayinu, as singing Manishtana and Dayenu. Eating the foods is as important as anything else. But first an interlude, because I came across a source which I found just phenomenal, and I wanted to share it. And I didn't want to kind of crowbar it into the share to try and just get in there. So in the end, I was like, I'm going to put it in a box. I'm not going to number it. And I'm just going to, before we go any further, I just want to share it with everyone. It's a phenomenal, really, really fascinating view of the Chatam Sofer. He says the following. Mitzvat aseh shel achilat matzah meshomeret b'leil Pesach. The positive commandment to eat shmura matzah on Seder night. Hi yechida nish'eret lanu mikol mitzvot achila shebechol ha-Torah. It is the only commandment left of the biblical commandments regarding eating. Ein lanu Pesach, we no longer have a korban Pesach to eat. Velo kochim, we have no other sacrifices to eat. Velo truma, we have no truma. Velo maaser sheni, we have no tithes. Rak mitzvah achat mishana l'shana. We have but one mitzvah from year to year that still remains in this realm of eating. And even that we don't properly get to fulfill because we don't get to eat it with the Korban Pesach. I find this, just independent of everything else, but somewhat obviously related to the theme of this year, a fascinating idea. Historically, in the times of the Beit HaMikdash, there were a ton of mitzvot that involved the eatings of foods. Right? Korbanot often involved eating. Again, Truma, Ma'as Hashina, there used to be so many mitzvot we would perform that the Torah commanded us to do by eating them. Nowadays, we don't actually think of eating as a vehicle of mitzvot. We think of it as kind of an accessory to mitzvot. Okay, you have to eat in the sukkah. You have to eat on Shabbat. But the foods you eat aren't a biblical mitzvah. They're just kind of they allow you to fulfill the other mitzvot. The only mitzvah left, and this is what makes Seder so special, is every single other day of the year, every single other Shabbos and Yom Tov, sure, we're eating bread or on Pesach Matzah, but we're actually fulfilling a unique and what was historically classic mode of mitzvot fulfilled through the Torah, which is the act of eating. And so again, it's somewhat independent of everything else we're talking about, but I did just want to share that because I think it's just such a fundamental perspective we don't realize and appreciate on Seder night. We are doing something, unfortunately, unique on Seder night. Our actual act of eating matzah is a biblical commandment that we are fulfilling, and that is the only time we get to do it. And unique mitzvot should always come with a measure of appreciation and also a measure of, there's almost a bittersweetness to it. This is the one time of the year we get to do it. So I just wanted to share that. And now we move on to what I have titled, excitingly, the Rachza problem. So I want to begin with two questions about Rachza, that to a certain extent, I thought about them, I came across them properly, and I was really thinking about Rachza, it never occurred to me. Rachza kind of makes no sense. So the first is, why on earth do we make a big deal about it, right? Every single Shabbat and every single Yom Tov, right? We do a lot of, again, big things. We make Kiddush. Kiddush is a big production, right? We make Hamotzi. Hamotzi, again, is something we should be doing. It's a big production. We bench. It's a big deal. It's very, very important. And all three of those we also do at the Seder, right? We have a special section of the Seder entitled Kaddish. We make Kiddush. We have a special section of the Seder entitled Motzi Matzah. We make Hamotzi like usual. We have a special section of the Haggadah entitled Barech, where we bench just like normal. But I would wager, and I think this is very much true, when it comes to washing our hands, we never think of our ritual hand washing, Netilat Yadayim, before we have bread, as anything significant, as anything actually momentous. It's what we need to do in order to have Hamotzi. But it's very much kind of like the awkward younger brother to Hamotzi. We don't really make a big song and dance about Netilat Yadayim until Seder night. Suddenly Seder night, Netilat Yadayim washing becomes rebranded. It's Rachza. It's this whole big deal. It's one of these stages of the Seder night. But it is literally the exact same thing we normally do. Nothing else particularly special about it. And we never think of washing as special, except on Seder night, where all of a sudden now it's been rebranded and it's this big deal. Why? Why are suddenly we turning hand washing before Hamotzi into a significant aspect of our Seder experience? And the second question is, to a certain extent, relates to the first, but it is just this first line of source number 7, which is actually a fascinating thing. I don't think we kind of think about, because we take for granted that we are supposed to wash before Hamotzi at the Seder night. But the Gemara asks, Netilat Yadayim Trei Zimni Lamali, why on earth are we washing a second time at the Seder night? Ha Meshalei Yadei Chada Zimna, we've already washed once, right? There is a general rule, right? We train ourselves to still be cognizant of a world of Tumah and Tahara, ritual impurity. And so we train ourselves to wash before eating bread. But at the Seder, we wash already straight after Kaddish, before we have Karpas. We've already washed once. why do we need to wash again before we have hamotzi? The Gemara doesn't understand. What is it? There shouldn't be a need for this second washing. There should be no reason whatsoever for us to have to do this a second time. The Gemara answers, Amri, Kevan Devoy Lemema Agadata Vahalela, since in between Orchatz and eating bread, you have to say the Haggadah, you're saying part of Hallel, Dilma Asochi Asche Lida'ate, Unga, at some point you'll get distracted and you'll touch something impure, right? You're not really thinking, you're at the Seder, you're doing other things. You might end up touching something that will then require you to do a washing again. So the entire reason for Rachza, at least on the surface, appears to be an abundance of caution. Just in case you accidentally made your hands impure, we have a second round of Rachza in order to ensure that everyone is good. So that gives me a nice technical answer as to why I need to have this second washing. But it doesn't, it kind of only doubles down, makes me want to double down on my question of why are we making a big song and dance about it? If the whole point of Rachza is actually a, you know, dot every I and cross every T halacha, right? We're just doing it just in case. Just in case your hands are impure. So don't make a big deal about it. We don't make a big deal about refilling the cups. That's not a special section of the Seder. We don't make a big deal about some of these other necessary components of just the functioning of the Seder. Why are we making such a big deal about Rachz? So I think the answer is found in a fascinating, if strange, perspective of the Bi'ur Halacha. The Bi'ur Halacha is the Chafetz Chaim, the Mishnah Berurah. It's his commentary. It's his commentary to his commentary. Right? He wrote the Mishnah Berurah. The Chafetz Chaim wrote the Mishnah Berurah, and then he wrote the Bi'ur Halacha as one of the commentaries to the Mishnah Berurah, fleshing things out a little bit. And he is discussing the question, what if you weren't distracted? What if you were peak concentration the entire time in Maggid? What if you definitionally don't need Rachza? You are good. The whole time you kept your hands in a, you know, a circle of purity and you never once did anything to worry. The Bi'ur Halacha says, V'hanachon sheba'ofen zeh, it's appropriate in this situation, yitma yadav kodem hanatila. You should make your hands impure intentionally, kadesha yocha levarech, so you can go ahead and you can make the bracha, so you can do it and make the bracha. The Bi'ur Halacha has this very strange perspective that we want rachza. We don't need to do rachza. We're doing it, first of all, to dot every I and cross every T. And now you're telling me that we should actually, we're not just doing it out of abundance of caution, but we should force ourselves into this strange situation. So, for me, the way I would frame this is that I think the entire point of Rachza is actually to force us to pause. Because from Maggid to Motzi Matzah, we all fall into the trap I talked about before. We think we're done. We think we're in the clear. So Rachza actually done well is, in a sense, it's Netilat Yadayim just like every other time, but it's slightly more of a production. We are slightly more mindful and conscious of the fact that we are doing it. We make the preparation to make hamotzi, the preparation to eat matzah. We make that its own section of the Seder, with all the flashing lights and everything that comes along with it, so that we are more consciously forced to take this break. We're not just going straight from Maggid to the food, but rather, and the Tilat Yadayim again is just how we get to the food, but rather there's this special section of the Seder for us to take pause and take a breather, to then allow us to once again think about what we are about to do, eating matzah and marrow. The entire point of Rachza is it is unnecessary. We should all do it, by the way, but we don't need to. There's absolutely no reason whatsoever to do rochza, especially if you are careful, but we do it anyway in order to force ourselves to pause. And maybe I could go one step further here. Really, you know, mitzad drush, very much homiletic, but nonetheless, it's seder. We're talking about the seder when better to go all homiletic. We start magid, right? You know, and this is kind of a separate thing, which we're not talking about, but the idea that Karapas is the beginning of magid, is the beginning of the storytelling. And we start with Orchatz. So once again, to reaffirm this idea that we're into phase two of storytelling, just as we began phase one with washing our hands and eating Karapas, so too we begin phase two of storytelling with another act of washing our hands, Rachza, before we begin the storytelling of the food itself. Which brings us to the significance of matzah. Obviously, there is a lot we could talk about here. So we're going to try and restrict ourselves somewhat to just saying a couple of things about matzah. Source 9, the Torah says, Lo tochal alav chametz, you shall not eat anything leavened, you shall not eat anything chametz, shivat yamim tochal alav matzot lechem oni, for 7 days you shall eat lechem oni, which is, JPS translate this here as bread of distress. It's a good translation. Ki b'chipazon yatzata me'eretz Mitzrayim, for in haste you left Egypt, l'ma'an tizkoret yom teitcha me'eretz Mitzrayim, so that you shall remember the day you left Egypt, kol yimei chayecha, as long as you live all the days of your life. However, the Gemara here, as it is often likes to do, notes that there's another way to read this verse. We have to remember that in the Torah, words don't have vowels. And therefore, words are sometimes, there's an opportunity for ambiguous interpretation. So Chazal point out in the Gemara in Pesachim, source number 10, Lechem Oni is what the Torah said. But you'll notice, if you look again at the blue highlight, it's written Oni without a Vav. And therefore, if we imagine for a second that there were no vowels, there's another word that Lechem Oni could be instead. If you were to instinctively read it, you wouldn't think Oni. That's almost a misread. There's no Vav there. What word jumps to mind when you see Ayin Nun Yud? The word Ani, which means a poor person. Thus, the Gemara says Oni Kativ. It's written Oni, but it looks like Ani. Ma Ani Shedarko Bifrusa, just as a poor person can only eat a piece of bread, Afkan Bifrusa, so too can we only eat a piece of bread. This is what we refer to as matzah, being poor man's bread. The obvious storytelling potential already there in anchoring the theme of Yitziat Mitzrayim is obvious. The whole point of eating matzah is this is the food slaves eat. This is the food people at the lowest rung of society eat. They don't eat anything lavish. They eat not just depressing, cardboard matzah, but a piece of it. Not even a whole thing, right? You get half. Maybe you get the big half, maybe you get the small half, but you don't even get the full thing. That is the experience of a poor person. In and of itself, that is a powerful idea. But Rambam takes us even further. Rambam says the following. V'lokeach shnei rikikin, v'cholek echad mehen. You take two matzot and you break one. Umaniach prus l'toch shalim, and you put them together. Umavarech hamotzi lechem min ha'aretz, and you make the bracha of hamotzi lechem min ha'aretz. So we've talked a lot about this between Mincha and Maariv. Always a reminder, we do have, I would like to think, some decent learning between Mincha and Maariv. So we've been talking a little bit about some of the aspects of this between Mincha and Maariv this past week. But the fascinating idea here is that you can do something on Seder night, according to Rambam, you are never otherwise allowed to do. The rule of Hamotzi 101 on a usual Shabbos and Yom Tov is, and again, for people who were just at Mincha and Maariv, this is bizarrely repetitive for this bit, you have to make hamotzi on two complete loaves or two complete matzot. Not on Seder night, says Rambam. Again, Ashkenazim, we don't do this. This is, by the way, why Ashkenazim have three matzot. is purely to solve this problem. Again, this goes back to what I talked about last week with the technical reasons why we do things versus nice ideas. There's lots of nice ideas as to why we have three matzot, but the simplest reason is because Ashkenazim, we don't like this. This whole idea of making hamotzi on one complete matzah and one broken matzah freaks us out. You're not allowed to do that. How do you solve it? Have an extra complete matzah and then we're all good. But Rambam doesn't think so, and there are many who follow the practice of Rambam, including, you know, the Soloveitchiks used to follow the Rambam, Rav Moshe Feinstein was reported to follow the Rambam, a lot of, even within the Ashkenazi world, follow Rambam here, that you can actually buck the trend. You can actually violate the rule of Hamotzi normally on Shabbos and Yom Tov, and make the bracha over a broken piece of matzah together with one complete. And again, I think this really, really anchors the power of the story. If we think about one of the major goals of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim is to either arouse the curiosity of children or alternatively to prompt children. You know, now would be a good time if you want to share this at some point in the Seder, draw attention for the next couple of weeks to the fact that as you're making Hamotzi on Shabbos, it has to be whole. It has to be whole. Look, everyone, it has to be whole. And then come Seder night, what's happening? Well, okay, we're all Ashkenazim. We're not all Ashkenazim. I'd hate to assume that people are not. I'd hate to assume everyone is an Ashkenazi person here. But at least we can at least pay lip service to the fact that we are now incorporating a broken piece of matzah into ham. We are breaking the rule. Because that is the power of poor man's bread. That is the power of the story, reliving the Exodus, seeing ourselves as though we have left Egypt. The major goal of Maggid is we begin as slaves and then we end as free people. To a certain extent, that resets for this eating part. We begin as slaves. We are eating once again, lechem oni, poor man's bread. And the power of that story, of that imagery, per Rambam, overrides a fundamental law of Hamotzi. That is crazy. The idea that storytelling can overpower otherwise halacha, but that's Sedanite. That's one of the themes Matzah is trying to convey. But there's an additional theme, which I came across, and I think is a really, really cool theme. So there's a fundamental question over how much matzah we are supposed to eat on Seder night. So the general consensus is we need to eat a kazayit. I'm not getting into the whole question of how exactly do we define a kazayit, but it's an olive. But we need to eat a kazayit from both matzot. And this raises actually two different questions. The first question it raises is, why do we need to eat from both? What's the reason? Usually, if you think about a typical Friday night or Shabbos day, there is no obligation whatsoever to eat into both loaves. Far from it. There's absolutely no reason whatsoever, unless you have a lot of guests, and so you're trying to, you know, you're trying to, or you just really, really, really like bread, right? There's no real reason to be eating into. You don't have to eat into the second loaf. Here on Seder night, we must eat from both loaves, from both matzot. And the second question is, why is it a kazayit? Why is this specific specified minimum volume mentioned when it comes to Seder? This actually gets into a little bit of a separate complicated question we're not going to address, which is how much of the laws of Hamotzi we learn from Seder night and vice versa. But broadly speaking, let's just assume right now, there is no reason to mandate a kazayit. There's no reason to mandate a specific minimum amount of matzah to eat. And there's definitely no reason to mandate we eat from both matzot. Yet, we do. Why? So there is a fascinating answer provided by the Prisha. So the Prisha was Rabbi Yehoshua Folk, though thanks to Wikipedia, I learned Folk as his last name is kind of like a made up last name. That he lived in Germany during the 16th century. And in the 16th century in Germany, Jewish last names were kind of a little bit made up. It's interesting and I don't really understand it. But anyway, He is probably one of the most important and famous rabbis you've never heard of. But he was a student of the Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Isserles. And he wrote a bunch of things. He wrote the what's called the Sma to the Shulchan Aruch, which is the commentary. And he also wrote two twin mammoth commentaries to the Torah, which is the precursor of the Shulchan Aruch, called the Prisha and the Drusha. If you want to get a sense of again, how important Rabbi Yehoshua Falk is, if you were to open a copy of the Torah, right, of the commentaries on that page that are important enough to be printed on the same page as the Torah, we have Rav Yosef Karo, author of the Shulchan Aruch, his Beit Yosef. We also have Rav Yoel Serkis's Bach. We have the Darche Moshe, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, author of the Ashkenazi side of the Shulchan Aruch, his commentary to the Torah. And we also have the Prisha and the Drusha. He is a far more significant, weighty figure that he's just not. For a variety of reasons, he's not a kind of a household name that gets quoted. But nonetheless, very, very, very important Ashkenazi figure. And he has the following suggestion as to why we have to eat from both pieces of matzah. V'yochal mishnehem biyachad. So the Torah says you eat both pieces together. Kazayit mikol echad. So you eat a kazayit of each. Sarich iyan. Why in this instance do we need more than usual? Because we're not sure which piece of matzah you made the bracha on. You may have made the bracha on the complete matzah, so you have to have a piece on that. But you may have made the bracha on the broken matzah, so you need to have a kazayit of that. I'll say it, it makes no sense. I don't think that's how brachot work. I don't think we are usually plunged into that sort of halachic doubt when we usually make hamotzi. You know, if you have a bag of chips and you're making a bracha before the bag of chips, you're not like, well, which chip is the bracha chip? No, you're making on the whole thing. What's he talking about here? Why are we plagued with doubt about something we are never normally worried about? So I'd like to suggest that's exactly the life of a slave. To be a slave is to be so uncertain about everything in the world. To have faced such awful experiences that you can't even figure out the simple things. You're so used to taking orders. Your entire sense of intellectual independence is so crushed that you don't even know what you are doing. And on Seder night, we are reliving that experience. So on Seder night, we get plagued by doubt about things we should not be worried about, because that is the experience of a slave. A slave would worry about the consequences of making their bracha on the wrong piece of matzah. A slave would worry about if they really knew what they were doing when they got into things. All of that just complete dread, fear, anguish, doubt is the experience of a slave. And so we eat a kazayit from each matzah in order to inculcate within ourselves that mentality, that sense that we do not know what we are doing, because that is the experience of a slave. On the flip side, the other idea I wanted to share, which is a very, very different take, is that when you think about what a slave does, completely different thought, but related to the same question, why are we eating a kazayit from both pieces of matzah? If you are a starving slave, you do not have restraint when handed food. So we eat from both matzot to symbolize our desperation to eat the food. A free person can eat with restraint. They know their next meal is coming. They know, you know, Shulchan Aruch is coming soon. We get to eat a proper food, not a slave. A slave sees the matzah before them and they eat all of it. They eat every last piece of it because that's what it is to starve. So symbolically, we eat from both matzahs in order to reflect that feeling of slavery and starvation. Again, that is, it's all about There is so much drama and pantomime to the Seder night. We are supposed to be doing a lot of these things in a very, very, very obviously on the nose sort of way. It's not, I think I said this last week, Seder night's not subtle. There's nothing, again, it's supposed to be child orientated. You don't go for subtlety here. We all are just so blatantly obvious in what we do. And that again is another theme. As I've said, though, the whole point of Seder night is to go from slavery to freedom. And so I think we also have a little bit of a reflection of freedom within how we eat matzah. Why on earth do we insist on a kazayat? What is it? Why not just a crumb? Why a fixed kind of minimal accepted amount of matzah to eat? So when it comes to the laws of Friday night, there is a fundamental question over whether or not, again, you need to actually have a kazayat of hamotzi on Friday nights. The Mishnah Berurah suggests one reason as to why you should. L'chol echad kazayit, you need to give everyone a kazayit. Kedei shelo yeh nira katsar ayin. You don't want to appear miserly, right? If you have guests around your table and you're like eking out, you know, the tiniest slivers of challah to everyone around your table, you're not the most generous of people. If you're giving out, you know, nice, you know, portions of the challah, right, there's a certain generousness there. And the kazayit is how we halachically recognize that generousness. On Seder night, we are supposed to go from feeling like slaves to feeling free. And matzah, we're kind of pulling double duty. We're doing both. So we specifically make sure we eat, but we give everyone else around the table a nice portion of matzah because we're doing these kind of simultaneously, which is again interesting to think about. And you can either choose to focus on one theme or focus on both of them together. But we are giving everyone around the table a kazayit of matzah because we are free. We don't have to hoard. We don't have to be miserly with our food. We now are free enough to be generous, to be people of chesed. And so we make sure every single person around the table eats a certain amount of matzah so as not to appear miserly. Matzah, I think after rachza, which forces us to pause, matzah gives us so many different opportunities to explore slavery and freedom. The simple poor man's bread, you only get a sliver. But the idea also of uncertainty of doubt, the idea of trying to eat as much as possible, even of your minimum share, and at the same time, this idea of being more generous with your matzah, they capture these perspectives of slavery and freedom. We think the eating of matzah is just this again, prerequisite to the actual meal. But done right, matzah is one of the more powerful storytelling devices we have at the Seder. But I think the most powerful storytelling device we have at the Seder is marrow. This will come as a shock at this point to none of you. I don't like marrow because I don't like lettuce. I don't like vegetables. This is always a very, very hard part for me. But I make peace with it because marrow is supposed to be miserable and bitter. But maybe not so completely. So the Mishnah, this is actually fascinating just from so many reasons. So the Mishnah gives a list of the vegetables one can have for marrow. Ve'elu yirakot she'adam yotzir behen yideichlo v'adam b'pesach. These are the vegetables a person fulfills their obligation on Pesach. Bachazeret, batamcha, uvcharchavina, uvulshin, uvamaror. We get a list of vegetables. I didn't translate them because the whole point is we get a list of, from the times of the Mishnah, things they knew. Right? We have identified all of these things, but the point is these are foreign words. I want us to understand that. So in explaining what this foreign word is, we spoke about this once. We had the whole series of the development of the Mishnah, the development of the Gemara, right? So what does the Gemara come along and do? A very, very important rule. It tells people who speak Aramaic, who are living in Babylon, what chazeret is. It identifies the other vegetables too, but we're just focusing on this one. Chazeret is chasa. What is chasa? So chasa is lettuce. Interestingly, so many commentators And then I was doing this. I had a lot of fun with Google Translate for about 5 minutes. So many of the various commentators tell you their word for Chazeret, which is always that language's word for lettuce. So Rabbeinu Yerucham calls it chasa, because in Arabic it's chasa. Chasa is lettuce in Arabic. The Aruch, who was Rabbi Nathan ben Yechiel, who lived in Italy, identifies it as latuga, which is the Italian. I know these pronunciations because I was listening to them all on Google. That's how you pronounce lettuce in Italian. Definitely, if anyone is Italian here, that is definitely a flawless accent. And the Chacham Tzvi says that in Germany, they call it salat, which is true. Germans to this day, they seem to have a different word for lettuce, but salat, according to Google, is still a word for, it's salad, by the way, but it's still a word for lettuce, right? Chazeret is lettuce. Again, there's this whole question over what should you use for maror. In the Ashkenazi world, classically, they didn't have access to lettuce, so they started using horseradish, and there's a whole controversy over you probably shouldn't be using horseradish solely. You should make sure you're having lettuce for maror, but that's a discussion for another time. We're not going to really get into that. But here is what I want to focus on. Prompted by this definition of chazeret as maror, which Chazal in both Talmuds knew to be lettuce. The Bavli does ask this question, but the Yerushalmi asks it a little bit quicker, a little bit clearer. The Yerushalmi asks the following question. Upon hearing that the definition of chazeret is or that maror is chazeret, which is lettuce, Hativan, they objected to this to eating lettuce as maror. Hare chazerek matok. Lettuce is sweet, apparently. Hare eino kare chazeret ela matok. This is admittedly one of those phrases which, like, doesn't work in translation, but, like, the reason it's called chazeret is because it's sweet. In other words, how do you know you are eating lettuce? If you detect the sweetness, you know what you are eating is lettuce. It'd be like if I handed you two mysterious foods, how do you know one is a potato and one is a sweet potato, right? The sweet potato is defined by, well, its sweetness. So too, Chazal say in the Yerushalmi, Chazeret, lettuce, is defined by its sweetness, which presents with us a problem because maror is supposed to be unpleasant and bitter. Rabbi Chia b'shem Rabbi Hoshaya. So we get an answer by Rabbi Chia in the name of Rabbi Hoshaya. I put in the ellipses because, again, it's more like language play, which makes no sense in translation. But then he continues with the following. Ma chazeret, techilata matok, v'sofa mar. Lettuce begins sweet, but then leaves a bitter taste at the end. Again, I'm admittedly the wrong person to know if this is true, but I'm taking their word for it. Kach asu hamitzrim la'avotenu b'mitzrayim. This was exactly how the Egyptians treated us in Egypt. Batchila, at the beginning, when we first arrived in Egypt, when Yaakov arrives down with all of his sons. B'meitav ha'aretz hoshevet avicha v'etachacha, they tell Yosef, in the best part of your land, settle your fathers and your brothers. They treat Yosef's family amazingly. The achar kach, v'yemaru et chayehem ba'avodah kasha b'chum, and afterwards, what do we read just a little bit later in Sefer Shmot? They embittered their lives with hard labor, with mortar, and with bricks. Things started off really nicely in Egypt. We were treated gloriously and wonderfully, just like that first initial bite of lettuce. It tastes sweet, so they say. But very, very quickly afterwards, it starts to get more and more unpleasant. And that is there to mirror the experience of the Jews in Egypt. In one mouthful, maror tells the story of Egypt. And then the relief that you're done with the lettuce, at least from my perspective, is true freedom. But the point is, and this again would thematically work as to why horseradishes just get like being punched in the face. There's a storytelling quality to lettuce. You give lettuce out around the table to either children or people with the mentality of children who don't otherwise like vegetables. And they eat it. And at first, oh, this isn't so bad. And within a few seconds, rut-row. That is the story of our experience in Egypt. Things started out well. It all seemed fine. I can handle this. It's just lettuce. I'm okay. Oh, wait, no, this is awful. That was our experience in Egypt. The foods of the Seder tell the story. We start our Seder when we transition into Magid, by really talking about the story. We sing about the story, we ask questions, we prompt, we do this, we do that. We take a pause then for Rachta, but we continue our Tzipor Yetziat Mitzrayim through the foods that we eat. We continue to tell the story through the eating of matzah and maror. And when we are sensitive to the raw symbolism of these foods, plus the halachic discussion that surrounds them, we realize that there is so much storytelling being done just through our eating of the matzah and the maror that, please God, this year at our Seder. We won't treat these two as the necessary precursors to finally get to the food, but actually as clear, obvious, and important moments for telling the story once again as our people, as we went from slaves to freedom through the miraculous intervention and redemption of God.